Hello, I'm Bruce Edwards, and welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. In this program, what to make of the spectacular increase of investment capital flowing into sub-Saharan Africa.
What we believe is that capital flows offer a lot of opportunity for the region, but they carry risks.
In the aftermath of the global financial crisis and with low interest rates in most advanced economies, investors have increasingly been looking at Africa for investment opportunities. The IMF's latest regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa examines what this increase in capital flows means for the region. Economist Mahavash Saeed Qureshi has written extensively on the topic and led the team that put this new research together. So how significant are capital flows in terms of, you know, the makeup of the economies in the region?
So the financial landscape of sub-Saharan Africa has changed significantly over the years. And the region has become much more globally financially integrated over time with a gradual relaxation of capital account restrictions. This has led to a substantial increase in capital flows to the region, especially non-official capital flows. And what I mean by non-official capital flows is flows that exclude official loans and grants. So flows or non-official capital flows to the region have increased from about a total of $4 billion in 1980s and the 1990s to around $25 billion in 2007, and more than doubled since then to about $60 billion in 2017. Now, in percent of GDP, so in terms of their economic size, as you asked, it's striking that capital flows to Africa have been higher than those to emerging market economies in the last couple of years. So we typically think of, you know, capital flows mainly focused or going to emerging markets. But Africa, when you look at their size of their economy and their financial markets, they have been receiving very, very large inflows.
And so what types of capital flows have you been looking at, and why have you chosen to look at those types of flows?
So what we do in our analysis is we try to disaggregate the data as much as possible based on the available data that we have for the region. So we disaggregate it along two dimensions mainly. We disaggregate it by the investor residency. So we look at liability flows. Those are flows by non-residents. So non-residents buying and selling domestic assets. And asset flows, which are resident flows. So those are residents buying or selling assets abroad.
So it's interesting how investors make decisions essentially based on whether or not they live in the country that they're investing in. Why is it that it seems that non-resident investors seem to be more risk averse?
So that's quite an interesting finding. In the context of Africa, it's mainly the non-resident flows that have increased over the years. The non-resident flows have increased from around $70 billion to $113 billion. A large part of that is still FDI to the region in absolute terms.
FDI being?
Foreign direct investment. But I would like to flag here that portfolio flows have also gone up, right? And that includes mainly portfolio debt flows or borrowing by the public sector, so borrowing by governments. Now, why do foreign investors seem to be more fickle or risk-averse? There could be several reasons for that. One could be that, in general, they may know less about the country they are investing in. So when global sentiments change, they run for the exit first. Now, you know, part of our analysis is what are the factors that drive capital flows to sub-Saharan Africa? And there are two types of factors, the global factors that are supply-side factors.
So in a better global economy, or more investors choose to invest in sub-Saharan Africa when the economy is good.
Right. So, I mean, there could be different. So within this category of global factors, you have, for example, the main drivers is U.S. interest rates. So when U.S. interest rates are low, money tends to go to countries in search of yield. So there are different factors, right? So in search of yield, when U.S. interest rates are low, people look for destinations where interest rates are high. The other factor could be global risk aversion, which is typically captured by the measures of market volatility, right? The third is commodity prices. So when commodity prices are booming, they, you know, of course, you investors are making more money, for example, and there's more money to be invested. But also on the domestic side, countries which are like in sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of countries are commodity exporters. They tend to be doing well, so they receive more money. So at the end of the day, the two factors are interlinked. But in our study, what we try to do is that we look at them separately to see how much of the money is flowing into the region because of global factors, how much is flowing because of domestic factors.
So there's been a lot of efforts towards trying to encourage private investment in Africa in recent years. And I'm thinking, you know, Compact for Africa is one example of that. But like, if you consider the significant increase in capital flows, is it fair to say that private investment has increased dramatically in recent years in sub-Saharan Africa?
So actually, it's very difficult to generalize here because, you know, Africa is, there's a lot of heterogeneity across countries in terms of their characteristics. So, for example, you know, the oil price collapse or the commodity price collapse driven mainly by oil prices in 2015, that significantly affected the commodity exporters or mainly the oil exporters in the region.
Right.
So there we saw investment fell drastically. Non-resource intensive countries have been trying to boost their investment mainly through, you know, there have been a lot of public investment and that is also they're trying to invest and boost their, develop their infrastructure, etc., so as to ultimately spur private investment. Foreign direct investment, that is actually, you know, foreign companies coming in and setting up businesses in the region. And that, of course, is also going to help have a direct effect on private investment and boost domestic investment. So what our research finds is that historically, if you analyze the data, which we do from 1980 onwards, there seems to be a very direct effect of foreign direct investment on spurring private investment and overall investment, and also then in turn supporting economic growth.
So a lot of countries in the region for decades now have been largely dependent on foreign aid to support a lot of their development efforts. And with that source of funding drying up, are capital flows filling that gap?
To some extent, we believe yes. So official development assistance, as you noted, to the region has been on a declining trend, especially since the global financial crisis.
Right.
And at the same time, you do see sovereigns increasingly tapping international capital markets, issuing sovereign bonds, euro bonds, to finance development initiatives. So for example, just to give some numbers, in 2007, the sovereign bond issuances totaled around $4 billion. And that has increased to about $10 billion in 2017.
Wow.
And in the first 5 months of this year alone, this totaled to about $16 billion. So this indicates that countries are trying to now finance their, those who can, are trying to finance their development initiatives more and more by going to international capital markets and borrowing from there. And in a way, trying to compensate for the decline in development assistance.
Okay. So in the end, is it a good thing? I mean, you mentioned things like rising U.S. interest rates now affect them perhaps more than they did before. Is the increase in capital flows a good thing, or does it just make them more vulnerable?
Unfortunately, the answer to that is not simple. I wish it was, but it is not. What our analysis indicates is that the impact of capital flows tends to depend upon the type of flow and ultimately on how they're used. Right. So portfolio flows, for example, are associated with greater macroeconomic vulnerabilities. And by that, I mean economic overheating, currency instability, financial sector instability. Whereas, as I mentioned, there's stronger evidence that FDI or foreign direct investment promotes economic growth as well as domestic investment. But having said that, what we believe is that capital flows offer a lot of opportunity for the region, but they carry risks. Ultimately, the onus is on the policymakers to manage these flows carefully, make sure they are utilized properly, and also build resilience. So to the extent that, yes, capital flows are vulnerable to sudden changes in global financial conditions, but at the same time, our research also shows that domestic factors also matter. For example, the overall openness of the country in terms of trade, the overall openness in terms of financial account, the growth, their debt levels, institutional quality. And there, what you find is that countries that tend to have better institutions tend to receive greater inflows. They help to attract more flows. They help to mitigate the effect of reversals in capital flows. So enhancing resilience, ensuring strong domestic fundamentals is even more important now as we expect global financial conditions to tighten going forward.
Great. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to be here.
That was economist Mahavarsh Saeed Qureshi, Deputy Division Chief in the Regional Studies Division of the IMF's African Department, talking about the chapter on capital flows in the latest Regional Economic Outlook for Sub-Saharan Africa. You can read the full report at imf.org. Qureshi's new book, entitled Taming the Tide of Capital Flows, is published by MIT Press and co-authored with IMF colleagues Jonathan Ostry and Atish Ghosh. If you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Just search for IMF Podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.